This is the Rutgers Quarterly Business Outlook for the third quarter of 2011. This program was recorded on Tuesday, July 19th, 2011, in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. I'm your host, Steve Lubetkin. Hello and welcome to the Rutgers Quarterly Business Outlook for the third quarter of 2011. In this quarter's program, we'll hear a panel discussion that includes representatives speaking on the overall economy, the gaming industry, and economic development. Our panelists are Luke Tilley, Regional Economic Advisor for the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia, Jeffrey Hartman, the President and Chief Executive Officer of Mohegan Sun, and Anthony Perno III, CEO of Cooper's Ferry Development Association. Now a few words about each of our panelists. Luke Tilley is Regional Economic Advisor with the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia, where his responsibilities include working directly with the business and banking community to understand emerging trends and business concerns in the bank's district, which includes eastern Pennsylvania, southern New Jersey, and Delaware. In addition, Tilley delivers presentations about the national and regional economy, monetary policy, and the role of the Federal Reserve. Before joining the bank, Luke was a senior economist at IHS Global Insight, where his primary duties included conducting state and metropolitan economic forecasts, building econometric models, managing databases, and consulting. He's also worked as an economist for the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. He's currently a member of the National Association for Business Economics and the Philadelphia Council for Business Economics. He has a bachelor's degree in economics and history from James Madison University and a master's in economics from Temple. Jeffrey Hartman is the president and CEO of Mohegan Sun. He came there in 1996 as executive vice president and chief financial officer. He was promoted to executive vice president and chief operating officer in 2004. And in 2006, he was appointed chief operating officer of the Mohegan Tribal Gaming Authority. In these roles, he oversaw the corporate finance and strategic development, including Mohegan Sun's Project Horizon expansion in Connecticut and Mohegan Sun at Pocono Downs Project Sunrise expansion in Pennsylvania. In 2011, he was named president and chief executive officer and ceded his responsibilities as chief operating officer. He has 19 years of experience in the casino and hotel industry, and before joining the Mohegan Tribal Gaming Authority, Mr. Hartman was employed at Foxwoods Resort Casino as vice president of finance for Foxwoods Management Company. He's a certified public accountant and has also worked for PricewaterhouseCoopers as an audit manager. He's a graduate of Rutgers University and lives in Connecticut with his wife and four children. And our final panelist, Anthony Perno III, is the CEO of Cooper's Ferry Development Association. Anthony graduated from the College of New Jersey in 1998 with a bachelor's in political science and economics, and he has a law degree from Rutgers University's Camden Law School, which he received in 2005. Since joining Cooper's Ferry staff as a project manager in 1999, he's developed and administered several major infrastructure initiatives, including the Interior Gateway Initiative, that was a $50 million planning and infrastructure rehabilitation project targeted at updating and replacing dilapidated infrastructure throughout downtown Camden. In 2005, Anthony was promoted to Vice President and Chief Operating Officer, where he assisted then-CEO Tom Corcoran to expand the mission of the organization from a single-purpose development organization focused on the downtown waterfront into a citywide economic and community development corporation. Anthony's a board member of the St. Joseph's Carpenter Society and Camden Greenways Incorporated. He serves on the Camden County Open Space Commission and also is the Assistant Program Director for the Northeastern YMCA Model United Nations Program and the Program Director for the YMCA New Jersey Youth and Government Program. At the lectern now is Tammy Bogatz-Steinberg, a shareholder at Flaster Greenberg, the presenting sponsor for the Quarterly Business Outlook, to welcome the participants for today's program.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Tammy Bogatz-Steinberg, and I'm a shareholder of Flaster Greenberg PC. I'm a member of the corporate department and chair of our gaming law group. I'm delighted to be here today. As you know, Flaster Greenberg is a longtime sponsor of the Rutgers Quarterly Business Outlook. This program has been and continues to be an important and valuable forum that brings together the leaders of the South Jersey business community. Our partnership and association with the Rutgers University Camden School of Business and the Chamber of Commerce of Southern New Jersey is one that we are most proud to support and be a part of, and we thank them for that. I am also happy to welcome and thank our industry experts who are here today from the banking, real estate, and gaming sectors, three important economic indicators for the South Jersey region. Gentlemen, we appreciate your participation on the panel, and we look forward to hearing your perspective and projections for these industries at the end of the year. As a gaming attorney, I'm particularly interested in hearing the insights of Jeff Hartman, the president and CEO of Mohegan Sun. Now it is my pleasure to introduce the president and CEO of the Chamber of Commerce in New Jersey, Deborah DiLorenzo.
Thank you, Tammy. Good morning. We're so pleased to feature another distinguished panel again this morning and to have a full room. As you have heard me say in the past, in this economic climate, maintaining your membership with the Chamber is more important than ever. There is no other business organization in our region that provides you with the quality and quantity of events offered by our Chamber, networking opportunities that can give you the advantage over your competitors. And just think, a potential client may be standing or sitting next to you right now. If you're interested in membership, please see Diana Meyer or Michelle Johnson, who are in the back of the room. They are anxiously awaiting the opportunity to talk to you about joining the family. And as Chamber members know, one of our most highly rated events is just around the corner, the Business Expo. At your places are materials about the Expo to be held here at the Crown Plaza on October 6th from 10 to 4. We expect some 3,000 attendees and encourage you to register for a booth. What a great opportunity in a six-hour period to meet enough potential clients to make your year. If you want a venue to introduce your products or services, want to reinforce your company's brand awareness, and want to interact with a highly targeted audience, you need to exhibit. For more information about the Expo, please see Mara Malloy, who is in the back of the room also. I'd like to close by thanking our partners, Rutgers Camden and Flaster Greenberg, for all of their support over many, many years. I'm pleased now to turn our program over to Dr. Jai Ganesh, Dean of the School of Business at Rutgers. Please join me in a warm welcome for Jai.
Thank you, Deb. Welcome all to the summer edition of the Rutgers Quarterly Business Outlook. First, before we start, I would like to thank our partners, the law firm of Flaster Greenberg and the Chamber of Commerce in South Jersey, for their ongoing support of the program, as well as the Rutgers Camden campus. I also want to thank our production crew, Choose Crews, who are filming this event for rebroadcast on Comcast, and Steve Lebekin, our podcaster. Today, I have a special group here that I would like to welcome. We have 43 young business minds, our high school kids who are joining us for the BizEd program that we offer every year, a summer camp for business students or students interested in business that the Rutgers School of Business at Camden offers. This is the 11th such camp, and we are joined by 43 very bright, exciting, eager high school graduates who I'm hoping will be potential graduates of the Rutgers School of Business at Camden. So welcome. Last time we got together to discuss the economy, I remember that we used the airplane analogy. We concluded that yes, we are in a takeoff mode, but we are buffeted by heavy headwinds. That was the kind of analogy that was kind of going on. And I was talking to some people in the crowd, and one gentleman said he had an opportunity to go back and see that program on TV just a couple of days ago. So I said, you know, the best forecast is that when, you know, you can forecast after things happen, but you know, but today, to continue with that analogy, if I say that some might wonder, are we flying blind? That could be a situation, because if you look at the anxious index, that's the index of economists who, the probability of the real GDP going down the next quarter when the survey is done. The anxious index is not that bad at all. First quarter, it was around 7.07. Now I think it's around 8.5. It's not bad at all, but the common man, you and I, the people in the street, the business folks, we are very anxious. There's so many uncertainty that is facing us today, particularly with what's happening in Washington. Will we have any resolution on the debt ceiling? What's happening in UK today? That's interesting. That has got implications for us. So there is a lot of things, a lot of uncertainty. Things might change very drastically in 2 weeks from today. But to help us with all this, to make sense with all this, we have an exceptional and distinguished panel in front, you know, with us. I want to first thank the panel members for being with us today. We have three distinguished panel members, and I'm going to introduce one of them and get them to, you know, start the process, and then I'll go along. The first gentleman to my right is Luke Tilley. Luke is a regional economic advisor with the Federal Reserve Bank of Philly. His responsibility includes working directly with the business and banking community to understand emerging trends and business concerns in the bank's districts, which includes Eastern Pennsylvania, Southern New Jersey, and Delaware. Before joining the bank, Tilley was a senior economist at IHS Global Insight. Currently, he's a member of the National Association for Business Economics. He's also a member of the Philadelphia Council for Business Economics. Tilley received a bachelor's degree from James Madison University and a master's degree from Temple University. He will receive his PhD in economics from Temple in 2011. While he's not a Rutgers alumni, I still want to extend a warm welcome to Tilley. Thank you so much for joining us, Tilley. And how we'll go along the process is each speaker will have about 12 to 14 minutes, and we will have, hopefully, 10 to 15 minutes for audience questions in the end. It's all yours.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate you having me here today. I was here a year ago. It was the first time I spoke to this group, and I think it was just as hot that week. So even though economic forecasts are subject to risk and change and uncertainty, I will say that I think, take this one to the bank, that the ice cream trucks are going to have very good sales this week. Other than that, high risk to the forecast. So I just wanted to talk about some of the highest level indicators today during my time. I'm going to talk a little bit about GDP and the employment and unemployment picture, and then also about inflation. So for GDP, we do not have the most recent quarter yet. Quarter two is concluded, and we'll get the number later this month. But looking back to the first quarter of 2011, it certainly came in weaker than we had initially expected. It was 1.9% quarter over quarter annualized growth. And right now, there are several firms who sort of track in quarter before the BEA releases the newest estimate. And right now, the tracking for the second quarter is that it's also going to be below 2%, possibly below the first quarter. So that's definitely lower than we had anticipated at the beginning of the year, than most forecasters anticipated. And I think largely attributable to some of the factors that Dean Ganesh was talking about. So I'll list four of them. One, the first quarter and second quarter heavily influenced by the earthquake in Japan. Even it was a large disaster, but even at the outset, the expectations that there would be supply chain impacts and impacts that went through the rest of the world economy, but nobody expected that they would last nearly as long as they have been. The second impact that we're talking about is the unrest in the Middle East and the impact on oil prices, the impact on all the distillate fuels that come out of that high-priced oil, gasoline being the most visible one for us, really has hurt consumers, sapped consumers' pockets, and then there are also other fuels that have gone up in price. And that really has, the oil prices have come down, particularly as Libya is starting to work its way out and some of the fear is coming out of that market, but gasoline prices and some of the fuels are staying persistently high. They have not come down quite as much as crude oil. The third factor is the uncertainty in the Greek and Euro area economies with their fiscal situations. There's a lot of uncertainty in financial markets there. And then fourth, as Dean Ganesh alluded to, and I talked to a couple of people about this morning, is our own current fiscal situation, the US debt ceiling. Obviously, we have a deadline looming, and there's uncertainty, I think, in the business community about how that's gonna go and what is gonna happen to financing costs. So the outlook, I'm going to talk about the forecast from the Federal Open Market Committee from their last meeting. They release forecasts four times a year. So from the June meeting, The forecast for 2011, so this would be year over year, 2011, quarter four, the central tendency forecast, which is just throwing out the three most optimistic and the three most pessimistic, would be for year over year growth of 2.7 to 2.9% at the end of this year. So right around trend growth. I will say that that forecast, those forecasts were compiled and came out a little bit before some of the more recent economic data, which has been below trend, particularly the jobs report, which I'll talk about as well. But I have not really seen any of the FOMC participants really revising their forecast down. Those four factors that I was talking about are viewed as temporary and transitory, and they really believe that the growth is going to return in the second half of 2011 as those factors work themselves out. And returning to growth of 3% for the second half of the year, the overall number for 2011 will be necessarily lower because the first two quarters were lower than expected. But most FOMC participants are looking for growth, higher growth in the second half of the year. Turning to employment, the last two jobs reports have certainly been disappointing, and people in the business community have taken notice. Just beforehand, before those two jobs reports, in February, March, and April, job growth from month to month averaged 215,000 jobs across the nation, that's nationwide. But then the May and June numbers were 25,000 and 18,000 jobs, which is essentially zero growth. It's in percentage terms, it's very, very flat growth. Those numbers are a little bit better if you remove government jobs and just look at private sector job generation, but still not very high. Looking at individual sectors, manufacturing jobs have certainly leveled off. Manufacturing had been a point of strength through the first half of this year, and that's similar to last year. The manufacturing sector had surged through the spring of last year and then leveled off in the summertime, and we've seen that again here. Locally, our research department at the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia puts together the Business Outlook Survey, and our manufacturers are saying the same thing that we're seeing across the country. And it's not that there's been a decline, but there has been a leveling off from the rapid growth that we had seen through the spring. On a more positive note, the education and health sector continued to add jobs. That was the only private sector that added jobs throughout the recession, and it is a point of strength both for South Jersey and for Philadelphia region and our area. So that was encouraging that the education and health sector continued to add jobs. The only sectors that declined were construction and financial. Construction has been in a decline since the fall of the housing market and the financial sector. This is just 1 month of declines. So generally, the other sectors have just sort of leveled off, and there's just been a sort of a hiatus here for hiring. I don't have a forecast for job growth from the FOMC. They don't put that out, but they do put out an unemployment rate forecast, which I'll talk about. The unemployment rate nationally has picked up over the last couple of months from 9.0 to 9.2%, and that's an indication of sort of the slow job creation. We do have more and more people entering the labor force, which can drive up the unemployment rate. As people move into the labor force and start looking for jobs, but job creation slows down, that can push the unemployment rate up. But we do have, it's not entirely that. There are a little bit more unemployment. We've seen the unemployment claims start to tick up a little bit too. Locally, our three-state area, the three states that Dean Ganesh cited that we have in our district, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware, the picture has been much better over the past year. Unemployment in the three states all taken together has declined from 9.2 to 8.2%. But then even more locally here, the Camden Metropolitan Division has been acting a little bit more like the national picture, and that's an uptick in the unemployment rate over the past couple of months as job creation has slowed. Camden Metropolitan Division had been up to 10.1% last year and had come down 0.5% or so, but measuring 9.9% in May of this year. We'll get the June number in a couple of weeks. So the FOMC forecast for the unemployment rate is for a slow decline in the unemployment rate, and you can view that on their website. But at the end of 2011, the forecast is for an unemployment rate of 8.6 to 8.9%, and that's again the central tendency forecast, throwing out the most positive and the most negative outlooks. And then going further out into the forecast, they provide forecasts through the end of 2013, and they are still seeing, as they have in previous forecasts, sort of a stubborn decline in the unemployment rate, staying above 7% through the end of 2013. So a sobering outlook for the unemployment rate. And then lastly, to talk about inflation. We have the discussion of prices and inflation over the first half of this year has really been dominated by energy prices. Like I cited, I was talking about the Middle East and the surge in oil prices and everything that's related. Also, we've seen food prices going up. And for a long time, the core inflation, if you look at core inflation, was looking at overall prices, but then taking out food and energy, that had been pretty subdued. But over the last couple of months, that core inflation has started to pick up. So in June, the overall index actually decreased as the core, crude oil has declined a little bit, gas has declined a little bit. That brought down the overall index. So in June, the overall index actually went down. But there is a two-month increase now in that core index. So that important underlying measure of inflation has picked up. Annualized rate over the past 2 months has been 3% over both of the past 2 months. So an indication that inflation is starting to come back, whereas last year it was very, very low. And that phenomenon is also supported by our business outlook survey. Again, our survey just of manufacturers, but a good indicator of how business conditions are. From the end of 2009 through the current, they have been saying, responding to us, that on net, firms were saying that their prices that they were paying for their inputs were climbing, but that they were unable to pass them on to their customers. Very much like in the consumer situation, there are firms seeing the producer prices increasing but unable to pass those costs along. But over the past 4 months, our business outlook survey has been showing that firms have been able, their prices received index has started to go positive. So it's actually an indication that those cost of inputs that firms have been experiencing for well over a year now are finally being able to push them through to consumers. The consumer has been strong enough, and that's another indication, like the CPI, that inflation has started to come back over the past several months. So the outlook going forward, coming from the FOMC, again, year over year in 2011, quarter four, they raised the forecast. The central tendency is for 2.3 to 2.5%. That's certainly higher than before, and I think that's in recognition of the surge in energy and food prices at the first half of this year. But the forecast for the outgoing years, 2012 and 2013, are back down to more normal levels, between 1.5 and 2%. And then I'll just close by saying that that there are private market forecasters who have this essentially very similar forecast for inflation, and that the bond market, you can see the sort of implied inflation expectations by looking at nominal treasuries and TIPS, the Treasury Inflation Protected Securities, and the implied forecast for inflation from them, very similar, five-year inflation at 2%. So in summary, we have been buffeted by these headwinds, flying in the turbulence. So I think that those four factors affecting growth are temporary and transitory. So we're expecting stronger growth in the second half of this year, but certainly there's a heightened risk for the forecast because of the most recent numbers. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Luke. That was a very comprehensive picture of the economy as it stands today, but I'm glad to say that you see it optimistic things getting better. So that's great. That's great news. Next, we have one of our very own, a son of Rutgers School of Business, Camden, but who comes to us from far away. I need to special thanks to Jeff Hartman for taking the train from Connecticut last night just to do this session, and he is turning around and taking the 10 o'clock train back to Connecticut. So thank you so much, Jeff, for doing this. Jeff Hartman is the president and CEO of Mohegan Sun. He began his career at Mohegan Sun in 1996 as executive vice president and CFO, and was responsible for day-to-day accounting and financial reporting. In 2004, Hartman was promoted to executive vice president and COO, and in 2006, he was appointed COO of the Mohegan Tribal Gaming Authority. In these roles, Mr. Hartman oversaw MTGA's corporate finance and strategic development, including Mohegan Sun's Project Horizon expansion in Connecticut and Mohegan Sun at Poconos Downs, Project Sunrise expansion in Pennsylvania. In 2011, Mr. Hartman was promoted to President and CEO of Mohegan Sun. Prior to joining Mohegan Sun, Mr. Hartman was Vice President of Finance of Foxwoods Management Company. Mr. Hartman received his bachelor's degree in accounting from Rutgers University of Camden, our very own.
Thank you, Josh. Good morning, everyone. A special welcome to the students. I think it's great that what you're doing, going through the two-week program. I congratulate you on your efforts. It's really a tremendous opportunity you're getting. You know, it's good to be here. It's good to, I'm originally from Voorhees. I don't get down to South Jersey too often. It's tough being a Phillies fan in Connecticut amongst the Yankees and Red Sox, but I've managed to raise one of my two sons as a Phillies fan, so the other one is a Yankees fan, so. A brief overview, why is a guy from Connecticut here? How's the relevance of the South Jersey economy? We operate in Connecticut, our flagship resort, Mohegan Sun. We have 6,400 slot machines, 300 table games, 3 million square feet, 8,000 employees. We have shopping, we have a 10,000 seat arena. And, we compete for customers that go to Atlantic City on the high end. So we study this market. We know this market, we know the tendencies, and the operators in Atlantic City do a very good job, and they're very formidable competitors. We also operate a convenience property in Pennsylvania, Mohegan Sound, a Sun at Pocono Downs. We opened, pursuant to the Gaming Act, acquired the facility from Penn National. We're owned by the Native American tribe. I work for the Mohegan Tribe of Indians. They've been a phenomenal group to work for my last 15 years. In Pocono Downs, we compete for customers that unfortunately used to go to Atlantic City, and we have experienced tremendous growth and in Pennsylvania at our property, quite honestly, at the expense of Atlantic City, and all of you as business leaders know that the pain it has been inflicted in Atlantic City. So we operate in both markets, compete on the high end against Borgata, Caesars, and Harrah's, and on Pennsylvania, we compete for the slot players and table game players that would go to Atlantic City. Gaming industry is highly dependent on consumers' discretionary spending. We compete for those dollars, and those discretionary dollars over the last 4 months have over the last 24 months have been under siege with the recession and what has gone on. Unemployment and the Case-Shiller Housing Index really play a big role in how we look at gaming revenues. And there's correlations between our revenue growth and our revenue decline in the Shiller Housing Index in the Northeast. As Luke said, unemployment has spiked up a little bit in the last 2 months. Consumer confidence has waned since it peaked a little bit in February. It's been steadily going down, and we are concerned. And when I look at the rating and on the confidence, the expectations, my 75 rating, I was bullish on my panel members, but we are concerned. What's happening in our industry is there's new product offerings that are going to occur in New York, which will impact South Jersey. The aqueduct opening of Resorts World with a Genting company, though the Asian consumers in Manhattan, and Brooklyn, and Flushing, who come to Atlantic City, who we compete for in Connecticut, who Sands, Bethlehem, and Parks compete for in Pennsylvania, they we'll have an additional supply shock to the system this fall in October, which will impact the states of Connecticut, Pennsylvania, New Jersey again. The winner will be the consumer, as they always do. It's operators will compete for those precious gamblers to fill their facilities. So the consumer, again, will win. Aqueduct, owned by Genting, as I mentioned, they pay $380 million for the license with the state of New York to open and at Aqueduct Raceway, they will be a very formidable competitor. That Asian market right now in New York City is highly competitive with Parks and Sands Bethlehem, Mohegan Sun, Foxwoods, all competing for that high-frequent Asian gambler in New York City. So that shock to the supply chain will occur in the fall. other states surrounding us in Connecticut, Massachusetts is contemplating gaming. So, you know, states continue to look at economic as to fill the tax coffers for the states. May of 2012 will also bring the opening of Revel in Atlantic City, which I, you know, from a competitive perspective, you could not have a better operator than Kevin DeSantis at Revel. You know, what he'll do. Kevin, highly respected gaming executive. He actually hired me at Mohegan Sun when he worked for Kirshner and they managed the facility for the Mohegan Tribe. You know, Kevin's an outstanding leader. He's going to put together a great program. What Kevin is going to do will be very difficult. He's going to try to get the Atlantic City consumer to try pay cash for room product and restaurant product, and will drive hotel and convention sales to the Revel Entertainment. He will be very successful. Kevin will be a competitor for us. You know, we have a 100,000 square feet convention facility. We have a 1,200 room hotel, and you know, we compete in that game, in that space, and Kevin will be a competitor. He'll be a formidable competitor, and that will occur in May of 2012. I guess the big question for South Jersey, you know, will Kevin be able to drive at Revel incremental gaming revenue, or will you just move business from various facilities in the boardwalk? From what I understand and looking at the plans, I think Kevin will be able to drive and recapture some of the guests that are now consuming the convenience gaming product in Pennsylvania. I think that he will be able to recapture, and I think that once he drives trial with the service levels, I anticipate Revel putting in place, you know, there'll be some guest loyalty that'll return to Atlantic City because, you know, I'm, as you can tell, a big Kevin DeSantis fan. You know, longer term in Pennsylvania, I think that table games have been successful. If you look at, you know, the 1 year, Susan Parmalee had an article today in the Inquirer. You know, I think if you look at Mohegan Sun and Pocono Downs, the 1 year anniversary of table games has been successful. It's driven revenue growth at our property. We now have a full gaming product, tables and slots. You know, we're close to adding a hotel at Pocono Downs, and once we have that, you know, we'll have a very, very competitive regional destination. In Connecticut, you know, we're still concerned about the economy and what we do there. You know, we are adding jobs. We're adding jobs at our company, actually in the social media space, but as we look longer term, today's consumer, our core consumer is the baby boomers. But as we look to the future in 2017, the Generation Y, which the group is just as large as today's boomers, you know, will take over having higher discretionary income. And how do we begin to market to that customer? How do we make sitting down at a slot machine appealing? How do we make the gaming experience appealing? So we are adding jobs in the internet and social media space, looking long term, and because in 5 years, competing for discretionary entertainment dollars will be even more difficult with technology and phones and what has happened in the entertainment space. And getting someone to come to a bricks and mortar casino, I think, is going to be even more difficult than it is today. So it's great to be here. I know probably many of you have wondered, you know, why is a guy from Connecticut here? But I do appreciate it. And it's good to be home, and thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Jeff. That was a very, very insightful commentary on the state of the gaming industry and some new things happening in Atlantic City. Our third panelist is Mr. Anthony Perno III. He is the CEO of Coopers Ferry Development Association, a nonprofit real estate corporation based in Camden, New Jersey. He joined CFDA in 1999 and has developed and administered several major infrastructure initiatives targeted at updating and replacing dilapidated infrastructures throughout downtown Camden. That is a lot, you know, a handful of a project. In 2005, Perno was promoted to Vice President and COO and assisted in expanding the mission for the organization from a single-purpose mixed-use development company into a citywide economic and community development corporation. This spring, Coopers Ferry Development Association, Inc., and the Greater Camden Partnership merged into a citywide development and civic programming corporation focused on redeveloping Camden through the development of Camden's cultural, natural, and institutional anchors. Pernod received his bachelor's degree in political science from the College of New Jersey, then saw the light and came to Camden's law school to get his JD. Welcome, Anthony Pernod.
Thank you. I did enjoy my time at Rutgers University in Camden, particularly at the law school. One of the things is that I am actually a South Jersey person through and through. I grew up in Lindenwald. My family is still living there today, and they started there a number of years ago. I mention that because I have also continued to grow with my family here in the South Jersey region. I now have a 2- and a 4-year-old. And if you've ever seen or want to see innovation, just tell a 4-year-old the word no. And you will quickly see all the different ways they come up with a solution to come around to a yes. That's much the way I approach the U.S. economy, in the sense that I've never seen the U.S. economy, at the end of the day, say no to any of its economic shocks that it's gone through. And when you look at the economy as it has hit its shocks through the years, what usually happens is the economy doesn't go back to what it was doing. It changes its direction and does something different. We've watched many years ago, there was investment in the urban centers. We go through a shock. There's a push to the suburban centers and all your retail markets, your malls, all your commercial corridors start to develop outside of your urban centers. I think that this most recent economic shock that we're going through is going to start pushing a lot of the development back into your urban core for a couple of reasons. One, it's where the opportunity exists. People are looking to spend money on deals, and there's a lot of land available in your urban centers that offer deals. Two, the technology has made it that location is important, but not location in the sense that we used to think of location as we need to get to our consumers, as to where we build our bricks and sticks products. And I think you mentioned this earlier, Jeff, that you're investing in your IT technology because it's not about bricks and mortar anymore necessarily. It's about ideas and how you transact that business. I can be in one location now, and I don't need to be in 15 brick and stick buildings across the region. So the location for me now matters from an idea perspective. I need to be around those people with the best ideas for research and how we're going to develop the next best product. And I need those people sitting next to each other and having a conversation. So how do I do that if I am a corporation in 15 small sites because I thought that's how I need to get to my consumers? If I can access the consumers a different way, do I bring them back into a different approach and bring them back into one single building where they can exchange ideas and save time? That is where I think the economy is going to go, and it's from that perspective I would like to talk about where I kind of feel the economy is at today and where we see the overall improvement of the economy. I am optimistic. I'm a developer by nature. I have to be optimistic. So I do see the economy improving, and I would like to talk about that through some anecdotal evidence that I see in Camden and what we're doing over there. I do recognize that there's a lot of companies out there that are sitting patiently on the sidelines with cash. And it's a question of when is that cash going to re-enter the market. It's not that people are necessarily broke, particularly at the corporate sector side, but it's a matter of when are we going to reinvest the money on the sideline. I'll get to that in a little more in a second. What have we been doing in Camden, and what can you see in the region as a whole? There's been an incredible amount of money that's been starting to come off the sidelines in the form of infrastructure. So a lot of what's happening in Camden and Philadelphia is going into the infrastructure side. So you see the Rails to Trails development over in Philadelphia. They put in a whole trail network. You see the Race Street Pier, what they're doing in along the Philadelphia waterfront. You see a lot of what we're doing in Camden as far as also new road work. I'm pleased to announce that part of what our corporation is doing is that over the next 12 months, you'll see almost about $20 to $25 million worth of new infrastructure going into the city of Camden, just in road networks, park improvements, mostly concentrated into the downtown area. It's that money that I think sets the stage for the next step, which is getting money from the private sector back into play. And you need to kind of lay that out to create those deals and opportunities. Although the private sector is holding back, companies like Campbell Soup and L3 have actually started to set the stage for additional development, despite their current employment contractions. When you look at what Campbell Soup and L3 have done around their facilities and how they continue to invest and upgrade in those facilities, they're not setting the stage and saying, we're going to sit here by ourselves as islands. They're saying, we want to have people join us. And I think that's where you're looking at as far as that infrastructure investment is going. You're going to see more of that infrastructure investment occurring around those campuses. The same thing applies to areas like Cooper Hospital and Rutgers University, which is you'll see a substantial amount of growth over the next couple of months. And it's supporting those institutions with additional funding that you're going to see coming forward in the next 12 months to 18 months. You will also see some development in the suburbs. The fact that Virtual has done such a substantial expansion along 73 and 38 is going to have a significant impact on the region, particularly in the medical field. And again, I think this goes back to what we've been talking about for well over a year now. The medical industry and your educational institutional industries are both expanding. That's where the jobs are being added. But when you really break down and you see where are they expanding those jobs and where are those opportunities being spent, it's being focused on the research components of those institutions, and it's being spent on urban centers. You have this relocation of Panasonic from, back into Newark, and that is being stirred by some other things. I'll get into that. But for the most part, you have stuff going back into the urban centers around these educational medical facilities, because again, it's about the research component of this. In Camden, New Jersey, you have what is probably the best example of this. Rowan University, with the creation of the new medical school, the tie-in of Curiel Research Center with the expansion of Cooper Hospital, all tying together to create that medical research base. For the longest time, Philadelphia has been the generator when it comes to the medical research base. It's industries over there like Drexel, Penn, et cetera, that Hahnemann, Jefferson, that are doing a lot of that. We send $2 billion a year across the river into Philadelphia in medical care and medical research. And the question is, how can South Jersey start to capture some of that back? And that is part. This is part of the beginning of that discussion, and having that connection between a good engineering program at a research university with a good medical program, and then tying it together with the graduate programs that exist at Rutgers Camden in downtown Camden. And how do you make those connections? And you see those investments starting with the creation of the new medical school by Rowan University, with the expansion of the graduate nursing program at Rutgers University, and the expansion of the on-campus dormitory project in downtown Camden with Rutgers University. So those are significant investments by the educational and medical community that is going to start to set the stage for additional research dollars to come into this region as a whole, but will have a substantial impact to the greater core. Along that same lines is there's a fair amount of additional institutional investment going on in the city. Salvation Army Croc Center is putting a fair amount of money into a large community center that will provide substantial resources to the neighborhood itself, as well as several other projects that are going on. And that brings us kind of to the private sector and where we see the private sector playing into this. One of the things that, in describing what the educational and institutional side is doing to set the stage, so you have the infrastructure that came in first, you then have the educational and medical institutions stepping in to start playing their investment out. The last critical component is how do you move the private sector dollars out of their hands into the marketplace again. And one of the things that New Jersey has done, which I think is an incredible opportunity, is the implementation of something called the Urban Hub Tax Credit Program. So we've put a lot of money into an investment program that really enables the opportunity for the substantial investment in your urban cores. This is a program, it's a statewide program focused in your urban centers that basically enables any business owner who's doing a $50 million project or greater, with at least 250 jobs, with 200 of those being created as new jobs, to be able to come into these urban centers and build their project at 100% tax credit. So unlike many other deals that you will get in the region where they focus on the value of a tax rebate that comes to you that expires in 10 years, what this is a rebate on is the actual value of the construction of your brick and mortar asset that then comes back to you as a sitting asset. And in many ways, that's worth more to a corporation than a lot of the individual tax breaks that expire after a couple of years, because it's an asset they get to hold on to over time. So with that investment strategy and with that incentive strategy, we start to say, how can we get that private sector back into the thing? I'm pleased to also discuss and mention that one of our first projects that we do see coming out in 2012 from the private sector will be something called Grapevine Development. This is the first new supermarket that we built in the city in close to 40 years. It's a mixed-use project with Lady of Lourdes Hospital, again, focusing on your healthcare industry, which is bringing back approximately 250 jobs from the suburbs back into the into their downtown, into their core operation with a mixed-use housing project. It sits right on the edge of Collingswood with Rucker, with Camden, New Jersey, with the idea that it'll act as an anchor to what Collingswood has been doing over the past decade, which has been phenomenal work if you've been down to the Collingswood core. So you look at that and you say, you know, there's the opportunity and how you do it. As far as the rest of the private sector and how that money will come back over and why it's taking so long, again, I like to compare it to my four-year-old who I've been teaching to swim through the Y, not by myself, he won't drown at the Y. And my four-year-old he's at the point now he can actually swim. Small distances, but he can definitely swim. But every now and then, dad, when he's not looking, forgets to pay attention and his head goes underwater. And he comes back up and he's scared half to death because he just went underneath the water and he doesn't know, where were you, dad? Why didn't you save me? Why didn't you catch me? What did you do wrong? That's very similar to, I think, what has happened in the private sector industry. There's been a massive shock through the industry, and there's a lot of people who have cash that are saying, I don't know if I'm quite ready to put it back into the market yet because there's a lot of uncertainty out there. You have an overarching debt structure, you know, that has to be refinanced. You have just debt in general that's out there, and you know, what is the U.S. and how is the U.S. going to handle it? And you also have an unpredictable tax schedule. People like to know what they're going to invest in to get the best tax deal that they can lay out. And when the tax structure looks like it's going to be in flux, people sit on the sidelines and wait to make that investment. And so it is those three things that I think are kind of the head under the water scenario that have kind of put a shock into the economy a little bit. It's not that people don't have the money or the ability to swim or to invest. It's that they're still a little cautious, I think, about how they go about investing it. We have seen breaks in that. We have been approached by the private sector. We do see it starting to come off the sidelines. You see it with Grapevine. We hopefully will be able to announce in short order another major development on the waterfront itself with a major office building using some of the programs I've just described with you today. But that is where we see this potentially going. And that's why I did give an optimistic outlook. I think that the 60 rating was about appropriate. Maybe I was a little bit too cautious. It's all right. So, I think it might be a little too much, but I do look forward that I do think this is something that we can survive. This is not something that is all doom and gloom. I do believe that people are starting to make those investments off the sidelines. I would ask you that you come to join us in Camden. We have some great incentives, and we're looking forward to it.
Thank you very much, Anthony. Thank you very much. Can we have one more round of applause to our panelists before I go to the Q&A. This is my third turn doing this, and I want to thank the panelists for one thing. We really have time for Q&A this time around. Every time I make the promise, I never fulfill it. Thank you all so much for that. How I'm going to do it is we can throw it open to the audience. You can have a question for any particular panelist or in general to anybody. It's all yours. Who wants to go? There we go.
Good morning. I'm Laurie Plan from Career Concepts, and my question is to Jeff. One of the national magazines, I believe it was National Geographic, was just cited the Atlantic City Boardwalk as one of the best. So if I'm reading that and I'm not a casino goer, what are some of the free PR strategies I can use to capture that passive market?
I think Atlantic City will have to continue to market as a resort, the boardwalk, the beaches, the entertainment, the hotel rooms, the restaurants, and capture. So I think you're seeing some of those strategies being deployed today by many of the operators, and it's the totality of what they have. Some of the new facilities opened in Pennsylvania, have limited amenities. Some have expanded, such as parks, and a very nice facility. But I think Atlantic City has to continue to go back to its roots in the destination aspect of of the gaming experience. You know, that's how we're emerging. That, you know, that's our company vision in Connecticut, with convenience circle coming around us, that, you know, we're marketing the destination experience and trying to deliver personalized experiences. So from our front line, from the time you arrive, that it's a special experience.
Chris Cruz, I'm with the School of Business program here. My question is for Mr. Tilley. You cited the unrest in the Middle East as being a, I guess you could say, like, fear factor for the economy. Is a resolution for the Arab Spring going to be a good thing, or could it also be a bad thing for our economy?
I'm sorry, the last set, or could it also be a
bad thing?
Well, I think that the most direct impact that the unrest in the Middle East is on oil prices and how that affects our gasoline expenditures. So we saw February 14th, I believe, is when the unrest erupted in Libya, and that was really the shock to the system. And so there have been some fears or some sort of risk priced into the oil market right then and there. Even though supply lines had not been disrupted right away, people were really trying to buy up crude oil because of the fear of it. And then as the unrest continued, there are actual limits to supply now, with a lot of installations having been destroyed. So I think the decline in the oil price recently has been largely an abating of fear, sort of that risk, but there is still the destruction of some of the supply infrastructure. And what it means for us is that it will, as long as the gasoline prices stay high, will crimp consumer spending on things like Jeff's business for a while, because energy for us, gasoline, is essentially a tax. In the very short run, we have a very hard time adjusting how many miles we drive or how efficient our cars are. In the long run, economies are very, very good at adjusting the prices. In the long run, we can adjust to price changes if prices are high, but in the short run, it really, really is like a tax, because we can't adjust to price changes, particularly for energy and gasoline. So as the prices come down, it definitely helps. It helps the consumer. It increases essentially their discretionary spending for other items, including Jeff's business and the businesses that Anthony's putting in his establishments.
I just want to say that I think that the presentations were really terrific. Anthony, I know you and work with you in Camden. Is not Mr. Dranoff taking his head out of the water and beginning some additional building in Camden?
He is. Dranoff Properties is looking at doing Building 8. There is still some environmental remediation. That is one of the projects we are looking forward to developing. Although I do see residential as a whole still sitting very much on the sidelines, I think in certain communities, again, where there might be opportunities that people will view as deals, you might be able to start getting some what I would call empty nesters or dinks, dual income, no kids, starting to move back into some of your urban centers. Philadelphia has seen this. The tax program that Philadelphia has implemented continues to drive that residential development over there. And so, you know, although they've seen a significant decline in what they were doing post real estate bust, there is still some projects that are moving. So
I represent the Camden County Workforce Investment Board, aside from the collar, and both of your presentations will impact the work ahead for us in the Camden County Workforce Investment Board. Jeffrey, the new Archbishop of Philadelphia is the first Native American, so I'm going to talk to you privately about maybe a casino in Philly.
I'm Andrew Manzo with the Biz Ed program at Rutgers. This is just a question for anyone up there. I was wondering if getting a degree, like I plan to go and get certified as a CPA, is that really going to help in the business market of today, or do you think it's not going to have a major help if you're planning to start your own business or enter into the business field in general?
You know, I am a CPA by trade. I am a Price Waterhouse. I was with them for 5 years. I think it's helped me immeasurably to actually figure out what I really wanted to do the rest of my life. somehow I ended up working for an Indian tribe in Connecticut. I don't know if that was part of the playbook in 1984, but seriously, I had exposure to different businesses. You know, I had healthcare, I did broker dealers, I did manufacturing, and I did gaming. I actually interned for the Casino Control Commission one previous summer, and that when I joined PwC, I was put on a gaming audit in Atlantic City, ultimately did some work in Las Vegas, found that the convergence of gaming and entertainment hospitality is something I would want to pursue. And then one of my clients was the first CEO of Foxwoods, Al Luciani, who's now practicing law in Philadelphia. He took a shot on a guy from South Jersey. And then that moved me into the finance role to COO to CEO. So it's worked for me. So I thought, the background, I was telling one of the business students, if you understand a balance sheet, I think you can understand what's happening on the company. Because the balance sheet really doesn't lie. So from a business perspective, it gives you a solid foundation.
Just a quick question. How do you develop small businesses in the Camden area? How do you encourage their development since they're so core to the economy many times?
About the best we can do, and I think actually small business makes up the majority of the economy. And we can always talk about the large format movers and shakers that move around, but the reality is small business is what drives the local economy. In Camden, one of the things we're doing right now is creating a program called Local Sourcing, Go Local, Go Camden. We're working with Rutgers University and all the major institutions that I had described earlier to put together a list of local suppliers who are operating in Camden, find out what their wares are, what they're selling, match it up with the items that are being purchased by the corporations like L3, and basically saying, hey, even though you're making this investment, it might cost a little more to purchase those products within the city. It's a right investment because you're investing in the community immediately around you. And that seems to have made some significant traction with some of the CEOs and COOs of those corporations. So hopefully we'll be rolling that out in about 6 months.
Hi, my name is Irv Sinkoff, and I wanted to address two separate but I think interrelated issues. One is the international and one is the infrastructure or domestic. It seems to me, given the vagaries of international business and the political situation in a lot of places, and given the decline of American manufacturing, the real markets, the real source of growth might be internal, might be domestic, which brings up the issue of infrastructure and perhaps even energy. I wonder whether any of you gentlemen can tell me why there has been no concerted effort on developing infrastructure, perhaps in the same vein that it was done in the 30s, granted declared unconstitutional, like the CCC, or even the TVA, which was constitutional. But the point is, why is there no concerted effort? Because if indeed infrastructure were expanded, it would create jobs initially, would help the economy, would make it easier for people to come up from Jersey up to Connecticut if there were high-speed trains. I'm just curious why that has not been done, or is there still the belief that the United States can do what it did in the 50s in post-World War II and expand its economy overseas? Take it.
I'll address a couple of things that you said there. First, just as a point of clarification, the decline of American manufacturing. We have had a steady decline of the number of people employed in the manufacturing sector over a long time, 30 or 35 years. It used to be 30% of jobs. Now it's more like 8 or 9% nationwide. But the amount that we make, the total value of things that we make in this country, in the manufacturing sector, has been on the rise throughout that. And as a share of total GDP, manufacturing GDP has been pretty steady for the past 20 years. It's around 20 to 25%. But the reason that you're able to have that increase in output while you have the decline in jobs is an increase in productivity. And our firms and our country has been very, very good at increasing productivity, which leads to sort of the characterization as the decline in American manufacturing, which is true for just the number of jobs, but we do make a lot here. In terms of it's just a changing face of the things that we make, more capital intensive, computer chips and not t-shirts, that sort of a thing. So just a point of clarification there. And as far as why we don't have investment in infrastructure, I mean, it's largely a fiscal policy issue for Congress and the government. I know that the stimulus plan over the past couple of years did have a lot of dollars dedicated to transportation infrastructure, high-speed rail, public transportation, that there were a lot of dollars devoted to that. I think, without being my area of expertise, that it takes those programs a lot longer to get built. Some of the programs were funding for existing programs in the stimulus program, whether it was Medicaid or a lot of things like that. And I think the energy infrastructure and the transportation infrastructure, there was money there. But going forward, whether there are decisions to invest more in infrastructure, that's purely a question for Congress and what they want to invest there.
Is that increase in productivity being absorbed domestically, or is it going overseas? That's number one. And number two, I am aware of what was going on in Florida with investment in railroads down there. But is that national? Is there a view nationally?
I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with what the projects that you're talking about in Florida, but just as a general economic concept, the increases in productivity can flow through to two different places, either the people who are increasing their productivity, the people who have the jobs operating the machinery, or to the firm. The distribution depends on the industry and the sort of the laws and taxes and whatnot. But as a general concept, an increase in productivity, if you make computer chips instead of t-shirts, let's say, that increase in productivity flows through to income and higher sales and higher income for either the worker or the firm. And I'm sorry, I don't know about the transportation project in Florida.
We may have time for one more question, and maybe two. Let's make it two quick ones. Yeah.
Hello? Hi, I'll shorten my question. I had like a two-part question, but for Luke and Anthony both, do you see any deflationary pressures, or maybe is the focus on fighting inflation or refilling the urban areas increasing the risk of deflation in the economy or in the suburban areas?
I think you are seeing an impact in the suburban communities already, in the sense that there is, if you even look at the commercial real estate market, it's starting to come back in your urban centers. That's where the growth is that we're starting to see again around these educational and medical institutional facilities. For the most part, other than that, the suburban market is staying fairly weak. And you see that even in items like, if you look at the Main Street project out in Voorhees, or almost all the Class A-minus B space that is running throughout the suburbs. The other thing you also notice in the suburban community along that line is that there is not large format space. I mean, there's a lot, if you're looking for a user of 150,000 square feet plus, you're not finding it in any one location. And that's very difficult to build out. I think that with some of the development opportunities of what it costs to do the new infrastructure to support those facilities out in the suburbs versus being able to do that in an urban center is forcing that pressure back into the urban centers. I think some of your suburban communities may see some pain over the next couple of years if they don't reinvent themselves, very, very much like the urban centers felt that pain over the last several decades because they did not reinvent themselves quick enough.
We have 30 seconds. Quick question for 5 seconds and answer.
My name is Charles Tersey, and I'm in the biz ed program, and I'm an aspiring politician. And my question was that if I do get into a high political office, what should I focus on to help increase our GDP, not only on the East Coast, but for our nation? That's for any panel members.
In 25 seconds?
A campaign plan.
I think... this opinion is my own and not of the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia. But I think that the fundamental drivers of growth are education, as you're doing right now, and infrastructure. They're the two key things that benefit everybody and have such high positive externalities that they have to be performed by government. Firms can deliver a lot of products and whatnot, but those two items, education and infrastructure, high positive externalities and are necessary. And good luck with your campaign.
Thank you all so much. Thank you so much, the panel.
That will conclude this edition of the Rutgers University Quarterly Business Outlook podcast. We hope you enjoyed the program. For more information on upcoming programs from Rutgers University School of Business at Camden, please visit the Rutgers website at camden-sbc.rutgers.edu. For more information on Lubetkin Communications, our public relations and podcasting services, please visit our website, www.lubetkin.net. Again, if you have comments or suggestions about these podcasts, please email us at steve@lubetkin.net. And if you send us an audio comment, we'll consider using it in a future program. Special thanks to Samantha Collier and Michael Sapanik of Rutgers University for their assistance in the production of these programs. And we do produce these programs in the studios of Professional Podcasts, LLC, in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. For Rutgers, the State University of New Jersey, the Chamber of Commerce of Southern New Jersey, and Flaster Greenberg, our presenting sponsor, this is Steve Lubetkin. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you out there on the net. Take good care.